This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. If asked to list the most influential scientists of the modern age, you might say Einstein, Watson and Crick, or Charles Darwin. And yes, name recognition and Nobel Prizes are excellent methods for measuring success in the sciences. But there is another, more modest exercise to count the number of times a scientific paper has been cited by other scientific papers. Do this, and you'll find the unusual honor of most cited scientist goes to a relatively unknown biologist, Oliver Lowry. But why? Richard Van Noorden is a reporter for Nature. He and his colleagues recently spent some time analyzing the 100 most cited scientific papers of all time, and he joins us now to share what he learned in the process. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Taylor. Great to be here.
So what is Oliver Lowry's paper about, and how often has it been cited in other works?
Lowry's paper was published in 1951, and it's just a way of quantifying how much protein there is in a solution by reacting it with another reagent. Sounds very esoteric, but in fact it's got more than 300,000 citations from other science papers since it was published. That puts it way ahead of any other paper in our survey. It's actually a very well-known paper among biochemists, but of course completely obscure to anyone outside of that field.
Well, and maybe because, not to take down its importance, but it sounds relatively dull to those of us who are maybe used to hearing things about, you know, E equals MC squared or string theory, something that's a little more sexy for the public.
Right. It turns out that many of the papers in this top 100 are these what you might call boring biochemical lab techniques. The next few papers on the list are also about measuring proteins and solutions. And that's because in order to find out the more exciting findings, you rely on these workhorse experimental methods. We have to go down to number four before we get to something that people may have heard of, Fred Sanger's first technique for sequencing DNA, now out of date, but that won him a Nobel Prize, and that is quite well known, but also a biochemical technique. And further down this list, we see software programs. We see theoretical physics equations in something called density functional theory. These are all used by researchers to go on to make the breakthrough findings that we've all heard of, and that's why they get so many citations. And I think that this list is revealing that what is important in science is not just the breakthrough, the secrets of the universe, as it were, but also the techniques and the methods.
So how are these scientific citations quantified? I mean, we must be talking about, I would think, tens of thousands of papers every year being published by any number of magazines and journals. Is there an organization that's specifically dedicated to compiling all of them so that you are able to look at it and have a big takeaway?
Well, this year alone, there were way more than 2 million papers published, and there's no database that captures all of these papers. There are just well-known databases that capture a subset of them, and we picked the Web of Science, which is an enormous, all-encompassing database. It's published by Thomson Reuters, the information firm. Their database has 58 million papers from 1900 onwards. So the top 100 that we're talking about, well, if you imagine taking the first page of each paper and stacking it, you would get to about the height of Mount Kilimanjaro, and the top 100 most cited would be just a centimetre at that peak. So it's a very, very select bunch.
So you mentioned process. What are some of the other general trends that you see as you're scanning through this list of the top 100 most cited papers of all time?
I think that the top 100 list also shows you that scientists in different fields have different citation practices. Biochemists tend to cite each other a lot more, whereas mathematicians don't feature in this list simply because they just don't cite each other's work as much. So it's a slightly selective view that depends on the vagaries of citation practice.
Well, that's interesting that you would say that because, you know, we've talked on this program about how papers, are often retracted, or not often, but sometimes retracted. And sometimes after they're retracted, they continue to be cited in future work. So I was wondering whether or not you got a sense of whether the number of citations is always a good measure of the quality of research.
Right. This is one of those cases where if a paper is highly cited, it is probably influential. That's not always the case. So Andrew Wakefield's paper on a link between MMR and autism in The Lancet, now discredited and retracted, has thousands of citations, but of course it's completely terrible science. So as a general rule of thumb, being highly cited compared to your field is a good measure of being influential or at least fashionable, but it's not a fail-safe measure. And on the other hand, a really influential piece of work, like Einstein's theory of special relativity, is nowhere near the top 100 list. It's so influential that it's become incorporated into textbooks and people don't feel the need to cite it anymore. But these are the exceptions, I think. The general rule is that if you're in the top of this list, it is an influential paper for good reasons.
Do people in the science community take pride in having their work cited? I mean, is that something that researchers strive for while they're doing work?
Scientists love to be cited, partly because, to be honest, showing that you have a lot of citations is a quantitative measure that shows you're doing influential work. So it's a figure you can present to your managers and your grant funders when you want to get money for your next piece of research. So scientists do track their citations quite heavily, and there's a whole industry of measuring how heavily you are cited. There's a number called the H index, which says if my H index is 100, I have 100 papers with at least 100 citations. And scientists proudly display this on their CVs. Some people think this has gone a bit too far, depending too heavily on these numbers as a way of measuring performance. But it's a reasonable guide, I think. And of course, what it does pick up, as we've seen in this top 100 list, is that even unglamorous research can actually be important and influential. So in a way, it shows that even if you work on software or lab techniques that will never reach the attention of the public, your work is still, in fact, very influential.
So given that's the case, do you think there's any possibility that Oliver Lowry or some of these other folks at the top of the list could someday maybe hope to posthumously or otherwise see a Nobel Prize?
Well, as I say, Sanger won the Nobel for his methods for DNA, but the Nobel Prize is really generally given for discoveries. It's not usually given for these techniques, which you might think is a pity. Lowry actually himself said back in 1977, he died in 1996, but in 1977, he said, well, I know this is not a great paper, but I secretly get a kick out of the response. And so I think that being heavily cited is kind of a reward in itself for many scientists.
Richard Van Norden is a reporter for Nature. He and his colleagues recently spent some time analyzing the 100 most cited scientific papers of all time, and you can read more about his work at wordofmouthradio.org. Richard Van Norden, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Word of Mouth continues with a look at a growing crisis in the sciences, what a surplus of postdoc researchers might mean for aspiring scientists, after the break.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. A postdoctoral appointment, known colloquially as a postdoc, used to be defined as a temporary position for scientists who had completed their doctoral studies. These days, it's become more of a permanent purgatory. In 1970, scientists could hope to see major federal funding by age 34. Today, a growing number of PhD students means that postdocs are unlikely to see that kind of support until they're 42. And meanwhile, they're not making very good money. For all that education, the starting salary for many first-year postdocs is only $42,000 a year. Carolyn Johnson is a science reporter for the Boston Globe, where she described this, quote, quiet crisis in science, and she joins us now for more. Hi, Carolyn.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you start off by telling me a little bit, just why are postdocs so important in the scientific economy?
Well, postdocs are traditionally, as you said, they're kind of an essential part of the training of future scientists. So all of the people who are going to run labs that make kind of the new discoveries and insights that fuel the economy or provide new leads for drugs, go through this postdoctoral period for the most part. And then they've also become really important because they do the real work of science, like the actual experiments. There's always a senior scientist who has done the work of often getting the funding for the work and conceiving of some of the ideas. But the people who are on the lab bench spending the hours pipetting and doing all that kind of the sort of hard grunt work of science are postdocs, so they're essential.
My understanding is that we're constantly talking about the need to push people towards STEM subjects. So what is contributing to such a high number of postdocs?
Well, what's happened as the biomedical research enterprise has gotten so big in the United States is that anyone who leads a laboratory is training way more people than they are going to need to replace them. You know, they might have a couple dozen graduate students and postdocs over their career, but they're only one laboratory. So when they retire, they aren't, going to need 20 other people studying some of the same questions or using the same approaches. Everyone agrees, science literacy and science jobs are important. What the postdoc kind of problem highlights is that the idea that most people go into when they get their graduate degree and then go on to a postdoc is that they're going to launch their own lab and be an academic researcher. And it's usually not until kind of late in their training that they realize, like, that might be really unlikely for them or just a really difficult slog. And by the time you're in your 30s and looking at that possibility, it's a legitimate question whether that's the best use of resources to put people in this 10 or 12-year training program.
Now, have scientists themselves or some scientific institutions expressed any concern over this quiet crisis, as you call it?
It's getting kind of a lot of attention at different levels. The NIH has done a study of its biomedical workforce, and the National Academy of Sciences, which is a major organization, has a postdoc report that's expected to come out soon. And a lot of senior leaders are beginning to talk about it as a problem that needs to be solved.
Well, it sounds to me like the career outlook for postdocs has been a little grim for actually quite some time now, but their numbers don't seem to be on the decline. So why do you think young people are still pursuing PhDs in biology and biomedical engineering and subjects like that?
Well, the one thing about this is postdocs don't consider themselves to be, some kind of, it's not like a social justice issue. No one's being forced to, go into graduate school and spend the hard years working on a postdoc. They're doing it because they love science. And there's a lot of exciting questions to be asked right now, things we don't know the answers to. Biology is a very, it's still like a fairly young science in some ways compared to something like physics. And so there's a lot of, reason for people to want to. And I would say, like, people do it because they love science. And if you don't do it because you love science, it's probably not a good thing to do because it's going to be a lot of work and it may not be worth it for you. But I think the numbers probably reflect, people wanting to be involved in research on, cancer cells or stem cells or, a variety of different areas of biomedical science.
Are there solutions being proposed? I mean, the obvious one being more funding.
Yeah, I think, everyone in science basically thinks there should be more funding and more, and perhaps more importantly, more stability of funding so that, they're not worried on a year-to-year basis whether they need to shrink their lab or grow their lab. People are talking about solutions such as introducing a new tier of sort of staff scientists so that the person who today is a postdoc but is basically kind of in a terminal position where they're doing really productive, important research in someone else's lab but can be kind of compensated according to that experience and also aren't treated like, sort of just cheap labor because they're being trained for something. Because if, in fact, they're not being trained for something, they should be, compensated as a staff scientist. Another solution people have suggested is just, raising their salaries. It goes down a whole bunch of different avenues. And so I think it's good to generate just a conversation about it, but it's hard to know, where the changes will come from unless a major kind of federal agency like the NIH takes charge.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this problem we haven't heard much about.
Thanks so much.
Carolyn Johnson is a reporter for the Boston Globe, where we found her article, Glut of Postdoc Researchers Stirs Quiet Crisis in Science. You can find a link to her article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now to an actual bit of unusual science, neuroscience to be exact. It's a story that starts in northern Maine with a workplace prank, and it comes to us from Emma Wetherill of Salt Radio.
You might imagine lumberjacks working all day, sleeping all night, and basically being okay. But at the end of the 19th century, there was a few of them that weren't okay, and they came to be known as the Jumping Frenchmen of Maine.
The culture of the lumberjack camps was very peculiar.
That's Dr. Marie St. Hilaire. She's a Boston neurologist.
They would go into those camps in the fall and would spend 6 months isolated totally. There was no electricity, no running water, no way to communicate with the outside world. And they had to really find ways to entertain themselves.
As well as singing songs and telling tall tales, these French-Canadian workers had a unique pastime.
They would go around and startle people in the group and found out who was the person who startled the most. And then after that, that person was always repetitively tickled, was like the joker or the fool of the group.
A neuroscientist named George Beard went up to lumber camps in New England in 1878. He found 50 of these extremely ticklish men and called them the Jumping Frenchmen of Maine. He even gave a speech about them to the American Neurological Association.
All of the jumpers agree that it tires them to be jumped, and they dread it. But they were constantly annoyed by their companions.
George Beard's work was a worldwide hit. Neuroscientists were fascinated by what was going on in the brains of these lumberjacks. But then, over the years, the Jumping Frenchmen became a curiosity of history. That was until Dr. St. Hilaire went searching for them with her father in the 1980s. She found men who are now in their 70s, but had worked at the lumber camps when they were teenagers. And she filmed them.
So we're in his living room. He's in his armchair. They're talking quietly, and my father just jumps on him, shakes his arms and legs the last 2 or 3 seconds, and starts laughing. And my father is laughing too and apologizing, and he said, "This is that your reaction?" He said, "Yes."
You see, these Jumping Frenchmen were so interesting to neuroscientists because they gave this extreme, exaggerated startle movement. It's very different to what you or I would do when we're frightened. And these lumberjacks would be made to do more than just jump.
They would scream to somebody, "Sing like a rooster," and it would jump on a table and start singing like a rooster. If you had two startlers in the same group, if each of them had their axe in their hand, you could scream, "Throw," and they could throw the axe at each other, and they thought that was very funny.
This reaction had become so ingrained in the lumberjacks that they still had some of the same responses decades later when Dr. St. Hilaire filmed them.
They would start working there when they were young, like teenagers, 13, 14, 15 sometimes. They were usually very shy. They were the youngest in the camp, and, you know, they were the lowest on the pecking order. Nowadays, we would think this is more like bullying or harassment.
All the jumpers that Dr. St. Hilaire filmed have now passed away, and the conditions on lumber camps have changed. But similar behaviour still occurs today. Just listen to these comments on a mental health internet forum.
"Today my boss startled me. He went so far as to say how it's daytime and that I shouldn't be scared so easily.
I jump out of my skin at loud, unexpected noises and when people come up behind me. It's a psychiatric injury, and in some cases it leaves scars on the brain. I've even seen the scars on my brain in an MRI scan."
"When I was in high school, there was a stupid game of coming up behind someone and flicking their ear. I jump out of my chair like a crazy person every time. I was very easy to set off. A skinny kid with no fashion sense."
"My name is Dr. David Marks."
David is a neuropsychologist. He speaks in this calm, reassuring voice because he helps children who have been bullied.
"When an individual is faced with a traumatic event or stress, there's a sudden release, a waterfall of chemicals in the brain, which is really a good thing. For instance, somebody being chased by a saber-toothed tiger back in the cave days would need to suddenly have all this energy."
Our brain is basically the same as it was 20,000 years ago, but now that process is being used to flee from a schoolyard bully. And those chemicals,
they're really not meant to be released on a continuous basis.
The overuse of our fight or flight response can actually damage the structure of our brain.
Either far fewer neurons growing or components of the neurons not developing.
Emotional harassment can actually change people's physical well-being. There's this project called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. They found that those who've had emotional abuse as a child are more likely to suffer from heart disease, cancer, and have a worse quality of life. When someone is constantly abused, it's not just their emotions that are hurt, but it's also their brain's development, and that damage can last for life. For Salt Radio, I'm Emma Wetherill.
Forbes magazine included her in their 30 Under 30 list. Rolling Stone named her one of the 25 funniest people on Twitter, and she's earned many accolades as a writer for Parks and Recreation.
So I would find myself getting very excited to write the real science facts in this book, and then would have to remind myself, you're being a nerd, you're writing a comedy book, so go write some jokes too.
Megan Amram takes aim at science and women's magazines when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever read an article that gives a rundown of the top funny tweets on any given day, you're likely to see a tweet from our next guest, Megan Amram. Known for her biting humor and her unapologetically unflattering Twitter avatar, Amram doesn't just write in 140-character blips. She's also one of the writers on the NBC comedy Parks and Recreation. She has a new book that is part glossy women's mag, part science textbook, and all satire. It's called Science for Her. She recently spoke to Virginia about the book.
Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having this show and having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. I mean, finally, a science textbook masquerading as a magazine for women. We've been waiting for this for a long time. How did you get the inspiration?
Well, I, as a woman with an admittedly very small brain, had a lot of trouble growing up learning from a man's textbook. I just couldn't get all those long words and pictures in my little brain. And also, the man's textbooks were very heavy, and my dainty little women's hands got very tired reading them. Yeah, it just occurred to me that I should make a lighter female-sized textbook that employed some of our favorite things to teach you about science, like the science of clothing or the science of cooking or babies.
Yeah, and apparently not a lot of people have a grasp of how babies are made.
I sometimes didn't even know when a baby was a baby and not just like a very small human man. So I really had to even find out what a baby was.
And Megan, it's so clear that you are a real science geek, you know, from this conversation. But did you have to do a lot of research for this book? I mean, did you already know the difference between Marie Curie and Marie Claire, for example?
Well, I did buy a huge stack of women's magazines and a big stack of high school science textbooks to research for this book, which I was very proud of my purchase. I hoped that I was the only one who'd ever bought that exact purchase from Barnes & Noble. But I really do love science, in all honesty. So I would find myself getting very excited to write the real science facts in this book, and then would have to remind myself, you're being a nerd, you're writing a comedy book, so go write some jokes too.
And we learn about winter's sexiest molecules, how to make a biological clock out of a potato. Where did you come up with these?
It seemed to be that a lot of common sidebars or quizzes or pictures in Cosmo and Marie Claire and Glamour and magazines like that happened to fit almost exactly on a scientific topic, which was so much fun to find all of the convergences between the two types of books. So I have a quiz. Instead of figuring out if your crush likes you back, it's a fun flirty quiz to see if you have cancer in the medicine section of my book, just because it was so funny to me, the idea that whoever is reading things like these magazines, that they would want to use all those tools to learn very real things about their world.
The book is currently the number one bestseller in the gender studies category on Amazon.
That's probably the proudest I've ever been.
Well, it's not a category known for humor.
No, and also Hillary Clinton is trailing me, and I gotta say, sorry, babe. Gotta get that number one spot. That's what was so funny to me, is that it was categorized as gender studies, but that adds to the joke. It just makes it seem even more legitimate, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, I was wondering about that. Does it suddenly put you in a position to be looked at, you know, as an authority? You know what I mean? Not that anyone might take the Paula Deen health food cookbook recipes seriously, but, you know, there are bits on anorexia. It becomes a bit, I don't know, there's a different kind of weight if people are looking for you to make some kind of commentary on gender equality.
Oh, totally. I mean, I do think in the end this book is feminist satire, so it definitely comes across as pro-feminist ideals, and I think does say something, but it makes me giggle to think of someone buying this without knowing that I'm a comedy writer or really having any idea what the content is, because it gets very crazy, so it would be quite a surprise.
Right, if they were really trying to understand the physics of nail art.
Right. If you think that this is a sincere textbook, and there are books that are pretty close to this, but they're sincere. They're like, teach girls math through the volume of handbags. And if you think that's what you're getting, you're going to be very surprised just a few pages in.
Has anyone taken it seriously so far? Have you heard from anybody who, you know, thinks?
I've seen comments online which have said, either, like, I bought this for my children, which is horrifying and I feel very guilty about, or they're from other feminists who are saying that it's a super sexist-looking book based on the cover. And I want to tell them, you're right, we're on the same team. If this was a real book, it would be super sexist, but I promise we're working towards the same goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Stephen Colbert, you know, you've created this satirical character that shares your name. Any worry that people will confuse the Megan Amram, the comedy writer, with this satirical Megan Amram, you know, the vampy chemist or science geek?
I want them to just not know what's going on at all. I think on the book, there's no clue that I'm a comedy writer either. There's no bio of the real Megan Amram. There's only a bio of the character who says that she's obsessed with her ex-boyfriend. And once her BMI was in an unhealthy range after a really big stomach flu. So those are like her claims to fame. So I think that I've always really liked when people blur the line in a Colbert way between what they're saying and what they're actually like as a human. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Comedy writing is still a pretty male-dominated field, despite inroads by some big names. I think of Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, who you worked with, Mindy Kaling.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's still so hard for women to break into comedy, never mind science?
I think you're just not raised thinking that that's something you should do. Until very recently, it was not a huge discussion. And then the past 5 years even have been this huge blow up with a lot of high profile women talking about being women in comedy, which I think is amazing. Like Tina and Amy and Mindy, those are all really great conversations. And a little girl growing up now might think, oh, this is something that I could and should do if I want to, whereas maybe that wasn't the case years ago. Though I was always a big fan of comedy and didn't want to do it when I was a little kid, but never thought I couldn't. So, yeah, I think a big thing about science, too, is that little girls should be encouraged to do whatever they want.
Mm. Well, this is Science for Her is a pretty raunchy book, humor book. I mean, we struggle to find parts safe for public radio. Carbon dating, at least on the surface, is safe for public radio. But, you know, is that the goal to be decidedly unladylike when presenting something like this?
I mean, I didn't think about it, and I don't know if there is such thing as ladylike. I'm very nice and polite in person, hopefully. So I wanted my character to attempt to be super sweet and perfect all the time, but then just be so gross about sex or her body or any number of things. So I think that juxtaposition is fun, too, is having her attempt to be normal and then be awful.
Would people, like men, unaccustomed to glamour don'ts or Cosmo quizzes, get this book?
Oh, 100%. First of all, there's just a lot of very unrelated things in the book. But also, I think even if you're a man, you know the tropes of those magazines just because they're so ubiquitous. And you also know all these stereotypes of women that I'm making fun of and stereotypes of men. So I think it should basically be good for everybody. Everyone should buy this book.
Well, already you're, as I mentioned, you know, just extremely Twitter famous, which I guess is how you got your start as a comedy writer. Give us tell us the story.
I started tweeting a few years ago just to practice writing because I was moving to LA and had never written for a professional show. And had no idea that it was going to become this networking device and this performance device, and was so lucky and just was sort of picked out of the ether, got all these followers, which has totally led to my jobs professionally, because I think now I have a portfolio of just thousands of jokes that I write every day. You can look back through every joke I've ever written online and say, oh, she's funny or she's not funny. So it's very useful.
Well, that's very humble of you to say picked out of the ether. But you were picked out of the ether because your tweets are what? What do you think work about them?
I think that I naturally think of jokes in very small increments anyway. So Twitter, you can only use 140 characters. So it helps if you're thinking of jokes in the pithiest way possible. So I naturally feel like I have an aptitude for that. I also just have a lot of wordplay, which I find to be I'm so embarrassed by it because I make so many puns all the time, but they always get a good response. So I'm like, I guess I'm going to tweet this pun.
Do you feel pressure to come up with really great ones? I mean, now you have hundreds of thousands of followers. Is there an expectation to be funny that makes tweeting feel like a job at all?
I definitely still feel pressure to do it just because I think, like, I've gotten so much back from Twitter that I might as well keep trying to entertain people. I think that it's easy to sort of lay back and say, okay, well, I'm done. But it really does stretch your brain, and it's a good exercise for comedy writing.
Well, Parks and Rec is ending after 7 seasons this spring. Where to next? What is your comedy writing dream job, Megan?
I have been so spoiled at Parks, which is so fantastic. So really just trying to keep making good stuff, whether it's a new TV show or books like this. That's the most vague answer, but just keep trying to make what I want to make, which I've been very lucky and have been able to do.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. I've learned so much about science, by the way.
Thank you. Me too.
That's Megan Amram there, speaking with Virginia Prescott. Megan Amram is a writer for the NBC comedy Parks and Recreation. Her works also appeared in McSweeney's, Vulture, and The All. Her new book is called Science for Her.
I am a scientist. I seek to understand me. All of my impurities and evils yet unknown.
And from comedy to comics. Up next, untold stories from colonial history filtered through the colorful lens of comic strips. That's after the break.
Just unlock my mind, yeah, just unlock my mind.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. As kids, we're taught an abbreviated history of the colonial period, a little bit on the Mayflower, a short lesson on the Salem witch trials, and of course, the story of the first Thanksgiving. Now, writer and editor Jason Rodriguez is re-examining the era with an unusual collection called Colonial Comics, New England, 1620 to 1750. From Thomas Morton, Mary Mount's Lord of Misrule, to the story of Eunice Williams, a colonist captured and raised by Native Americans, this illustrated collection, which Jason edited, opens up underappreciated stories from New England's rich colonial history. And Jason Rodriguez, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
So you are also involved with another collection called District Comics, an unconventional history of Washington, D.C. Now, is there something about exploring history through visual imagery that really resonates with you?
Oh, I definitely think so, Taylor. There is this sense of context that you get with comic books that you don't really get when you just read a history text. So when someone is taking in a comic book and looking at a panel, they have the option to slow down their pace, look at the clothes that people were wearing, the environment, the time of day, a lot of things that you don't normally get by just telling someone, you know, George Washington crossed the Delaware River. When you see the picture, you get a lot more of the visual cues and context associated with it. I mean, I used to love when I was a kid, the whenever you read about the American Revolution, it always starts with these war maps, you know, and they would follow the dotted line, and you would follow, you know, this army went to this bridge and fought over this river, and it really kind of put the entire battle into perspective, so then you could dig more into the minutia. So comic books affords that as well, and allows you to really, you know, appreciate the bigger picture before getting into the tinier details.
Now, each separate story here, each vignette, features its own writer and illustrator. Now, what is the advantage of having this broken up and being done by a number of people rather than just one writer and illustrator throughout?
Well, I think it actually helps to bring in a lot of histories that I wouldn't think about as a writer, for sure. A lot of these stories came to me from people who just happened to know this little interesting bit of history, or something where I actually discovered a person like Elizabeth Glover, who brought the first printing press, and I went to a writer and said, hey, can you find out more? Erica Swiler, in this case. And she did a really great job of finding probably more than I would have been able to do on my own if I was writing all 17 of these stories. It also allows you to bring in these more famous historians who wrote great history text about topics that aren't normally covered in the, you know, K-12 curriculum, and they're experts in the field, and they don't need to do all this extensive research, so they could really put together a story for you that is much more robust than something you could do on your own.
And the one that you just mentioned, Elizabeth Glover and the first printing press, that's one of those stories that sounds, you know, sort of quaint at heart, a classic colonial story, but there's some really big implications there. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I came across Elizabeth Glover when I was just looking up names of people that I didn't know, essentially, from the period.
Right.
And the only thing I knew about her, as mentioned, is that she brought the first printing press to America. So I talked to a writer friend of mine, Erica Swiler, and asked her if she could, you know, dig a little deeper. And it turns out that Elizabeth Glover's husband was actually the first person to attempt to bring a printing press over, but he died en route. So Elizabeth Glover was left with two of his essentially indentured servants, two people who owed a debt to him, a bunch of kids, and a printing press, and really no means to set up a business to use this printing press. So she had to rely on her husband's debtors to actually set up and run the shop and be the public face of the shop. She was relying pretty strongly on Harvard opening up and bringing them business, and Harvard's opening was delayed. So she was a bit of an entrepreneur, and she just started printing books. The Besson book was the first book printed in America, and it was printed in her shop. It was riddled with errors, which was actually kind of funny. But eventually Harvard opened, and she got into a relationship with the headmaster of the school and bought lots of land. And it scales up to this story. It started with, all I know is this woman bought a printing press over, and it scaled up to the story about women business owners and indentured servitude and the history of Harvard. There was so much more there that really kind of brought out this new story that I never expected when I just gave her this one-line description of what I wanted.
Now, how does one go about editing comics, I guess, compared especially to more conventional editing that we think of with a novel or nonfiction?
It's a very detailed process, to say the least. I'm a very hands-on editor, so I like to start from the very basic little germ of a story and help the writer develop it into this full piece. So I request scripts, and then when we get artists working on it, I request basically storyboards or thumbnails, and then pencils, and then inks, and then colors, and then every step has an approval process to it. On top of that, there's a certain vision that I like to put on top of books, and I like to make them feel like a more cohesive anthology. So there's a lot of oversight. There's a lot of managing various creators. I had 33 people in this book. And on top of that, I'm so hands-on that I actually designed the entire book as well, because I had a very specific vision for it, and I wanted to make sure that it came out the way that I thought would work best.
I'm speaking with Jason Rodriguez. He's editor of Colonial Comics, New England, from 1620 to 1750. One of my favorite stories from the collection, Jason, is about how livestock became a focal point for growing tensions between colonists and Native Americans. Now, this is a really interesting story because it doesn't really have any dialogue. You know, there's no speech bubbles. It's all told through pictures. And it's another relatively short story with big implications.
That was one of the first ones I started to work on when I started putting this collection together. And I read Virginia the John Anderson's wonderful book, Creatures of Empire, which was about the implications of free-range animal husbandry, which is, as you said, a very difficult topic to tackle. So I found her email address. I wrote her, and I said, have you ever thought about creating a comic book about free-range animal husbandry suitable for middle schoolers and high schoolers?
And she said, yes, I've been thinking about that forever.
Yeah, she's been thinking about it her entire life. No, she obviously she never even thought about it once. But through a couple of emails and phone calls, we figured out what a story like this would look like. We decided to make it silent because, you know, one of the main issues was communication. A lot of these Native Americans, they didn't know what livestock was. They hadn't seen livestock until the colonists brought them over. And there was these difficulties in communicating the purpose of livestock of sorts, and the fact that these livestock needed all this land. So they would go out and they would eat all the Native American crops, and tensions would escalate, essentially. So we wanted to capture that lack of real communication by making the story silent. And it took a tremendous artist like Mike Seeger to really bring that to life. And I think it works fantastically, and it scales up. So it's the kind of story that a younger reader can appreciate. And as you get older, you start to appreciate more of the nuances and how this isn't just a story about a couple of pigs eating crops. This is really a story about one of the foundational issues between these two cultures that intersected.
You know, were you thinking early on, I could see this, you know, being put in schools, I could see this being used for classroom use, or did that just sort of spring up on its own?
No, it was definitely the intention from the beginning. When I was talking to my publisher at Fulcrum, that was what we wanted to do. We wanted something that could be enjoyed by adults, but something that also would get kids interested in history, essentially, by showing them some of the stories that they're not necessarily familiar with. So it was always part of the plan. I tried to strengthen that direction a bit after the American Library Association. I talked to a bunch of librarians and educators and tried to figure out what they would want from a book like this. But I do know that there is one school in Chicago that actually used the free-range animal husbandry story, since it is silent, to teach their kids about inferencing and look at artwork and figure out what's being shown and what's actually the intention behind the artwork. So I know that's certainly happening. I know there are a lot of teachers. On Twitter, I see some social study teachers talking about it at one point and saying how it's a great tool. So that's good. And I've also talked to some homeschoolers who are interested in using this in their curriculums with their kids moving forward. So although it's only been a month, I'm getting some pretty positive feedback, and I'm very excited about that.
Well, Jason, one of the things I've noticed, the first Thanksgiving is definitely absent from this collection.
Yeah, it was actually when we were putting together this book and we were just writing down stories to include, it seemed so obvious to include something on the first Thanksgiving and the true story of the first Thanksgiving. And I think as we started finding these smaller stories that were more, I think, people focused, mm-hmm. It just sort of dropped out because the narratives that focused on the individuals just tended to be much more exciting, I think, than the story of the first Thanksgiving. So that was one of the ones that went away along with several other stories so that we could focus on some of the more interesting people, I think.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
Jason Rodriguez is the editor of Colonial Comics. You can find a link to his website and more about the collection at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott, and join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.